This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And we are, as I understand it, approaching the end of the COVID emergency. But we are not approaching the end of COVID and its presence. For those of you keeping track, today is the 133rd consecutive program since an emergency was declared regarding the COVID pandemic. And the good news is our COVID positivity rate remains here in Connecticut to be about 3%, which for most people has been an acceptable level. Yet we ask people to be cautious when in close contact with others. But there's a lot of confusion surrounding COVID right now regarding the changes, right? Thursday's May 11th. And that's going to be when they declare the end of the COVID emergency by the federal government. So things are going to change in terms of having to pay for things that were previously not paid for, like COVID testing, COVID vaccination, things such as that. So we're having Dr. David Banik is going to call us. Dr. Banik, as many of you know, is an infectious disease specialist. He's been on our program before. He's associate professor and head of the infection prevention program at the University of Connecticut. So he's going to try and clarify some of the things regarding vaccine status, who is available, when you should get it, what is going to happen. We're going to try and ask him what's going to happen in the fall and a little bit more about the masking guidelines. So if you use the hospital services here locally, you'll know that at Hartford Hospital, they changed the masking requirements. They're also changed at the University of Connecticut this past week. So we're going to chat with Dr. Banik. And then in the second half of our program, my guest is going to be Dr. Alexander Mbebwe. Dr. Mbebwe is an internist, internal medicine specialist, who went into the specialty of palliative care, a new topic for our program, something we haven't talked about that we're hearing more and more about. So we're going to spend the second half of the program with Dr. Mbebwe chatting about that. This day in medicine, May 6, 1830, was the day Dr. Abraham Jacobi was born. Dr. Jacobi was born in Germany, but spent his professional career here in the United States as a pediatrician. He's considered the father of American pediatrics and really one of the founders. Oddly, back then, obstetrics and pediatrics were closely aligned, and he's one of the founders of the American Journal of Obstetrics, but he was president of the AMA, the American Medical Association, and he wrote a lot of books on dentition, infant feeding, intestinal diseases in children. What I remember the most is that there is a medical center in the Bronx, in Bronx, New York, that was not far from my home, Jacobi Medical Center, that is still in existence. It's a huge medical center that provides care primarily for the underserved. It is a city hospital. And so he is remembered today. One of the things that many people may have noticed in this past week is an attack at a medical office in Atlanta, Georgia. These attacks are becoming more frequent, right? And we're familiar with these so-called, I guess what they call the soft targets, right? Where your defense is relatively low. Schools, hospitals, medical offices, churches, right, where people are not expecting to be attacked. And in this case, it was in a waiting room, a disturbed individual was frustrated. Apparently, he wanted to get some medication, and I don't know why he wasn't getting it, but decided to take out a weapon and kill one person and wound several others who were just innocently waiting in the waiting room. This is kind of frightening. Now, a lot of people, when we hear this, we're starting to think, well, not here in Connecticut. Well, it has happened in Connecticut. I know for a fact, my previous internist had his office attacked. Basically, it was on a Sunday, and fortunately, no one was there. And I say fortunately because it's not uncommon for doctors to go into the office on Sunday to try and catch up on paperwork. And some person had a gripe with the office or someone in the office, and from a distance, with a long gun, decided to open fire on the office. So it happens here. And it's important for us to be aware of these things and to start protecting ourselves. And I see that at Hartford Hospital now, when you go into the hospital from any of the entrances, you have to go through a metal detector. And there is a security guard there, someone who's trained, if they need to stop somebody. So it's unfortunate that we have to get to this point. It's clear that we have to start taking some means of defending ourselves in this situation. And also, when we're at the doctor's office or in a medical center, to be aware of what's going on, being aware of our surroundings. And I know people saying, well, you know, there's a mental health crisis. There is. We used to have state hospitals. And we don't have those anymore, right? That was the feedback from the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. People all saw that and said, oh, we have to close the state hospitals. But these were safe environments where people got care. They were not torture chambers at all. They really served a very benign and benevolent purpose here in Connecticut. So again, we need to be aware of these things, and we need to urge our political leaders to take a stand on these issues, because the most important thing they're going to do is to keep us safe and to know our families are safe when they go to the doctor, when they go to a hospital, when they go to a church, and more importantly, when our children go to school. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. David Banik. We're going to talk about where are we in the midst of the COVID crisis. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And if you have questions for us, even while we're live on the air, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. My guest right now is Dr. David Banik. Dr. Banik is an infectious disease specialist. He's associate professor of internal medicine at the University of Connecticut, and he's head of the infection prevention program. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Dr. Leslie. Thanks for having me on again.
So let's chat a little bit, because we had a conversation this week. Because to be honest with you, if I'm confused, I got to think a lot of our listeners are confused about who is eligible for the latest COVID vaccination in terms of should we be getting it, shouldn't we be getting it? Can you clarify, first of all, there is, I understand now, an FDA-approved booster for COVID, correct?
That's correct. So, I think the communication has been a little confusing. So very recently, the FDA authorized an eligibility for a second COVID booster for individuals, here in the U.S. And the focus is really on populations who are at higher risk. So individuals over 65, immunocompromised individuals under age 65. And that's really the group that's eligible for a second booster. So you may recall back in the fall, the Omicron-specific bivalent booster became available, and that really became the standard booster that's been given since then. And now those individuals at higher risk are eligible for a second booster with that Omicron-specific bivalent booster if they meet that criteria of being older than 65 or immunocompromised.
Okay. And those are readily available now?
Yes. So now all of the vaccines that are available are the bivalent booster. The monovalent booster, which is the older vaccine, or the monovalent vaccine, is not no longer available. Now all vaccines are bivalent, and all the pharmacies carry these and are now able to give them to those individuals at higher risk.
Just quickly, can you explain to our listeners what bivalent is versus monovalent?
So the original COVID vaccine was designed based on the first variant that was identified back, in 2020. And subsequently, as the virus changed and we've developed a predominance of the Omicron subvariant, the booster was updated to become a bivalent booster, which contains two different strains, including the Omicron-specific variant, which is the primary circulating variant. So just like how we update our flu vaccines year to year, we've been able to update this COVID vaccine to address the more recently circulating variants and provide a more specific kind of protection.
So on May 11th, the United States has declared the end of the COVID emergency, is what I understand. I think the WHO is somehow involved. But what does that mean to our listeners? Come Thursday, what changes?
So I think there's a few things that make this announcement significant. So, I think the U.S. and the WHO are signifying that the pandemic phase of COVID-19 is over. So we're no longer in that emergency phase that we have been in for the first few years. And now it seems like we're looking at COVID as more of a respiratory virus that's going to be with us, circulating kind of more routinely. So the virus itself isn't gone, but it isn't at the pandemic level that we had seen previously. Now, I think in a practical sense, this is going to have a few implications for us. So, by declaring the end of the pandemic, the government has changed its approach to providing things like testing. So testing, which had been universally available at no cost to the general public, now is going to be handled in a similar way that other clinical labs are testing is performed. And, things like billing insurance and paying for the cost of these tests is going to be part of that picture. I think the other big piece that's going to change is the way that we collect data on COVID. So the U.S. had extensive data collection systems in place to track positive tests, to track negative tests, and get things like positivity rates. You may have heard that metric discussed. And now labs are not going to be required to report test results in that level of detail. And the way that we look at our metrics, our data, is going to be a little bit different than we have in the past. So I think those are the big changes that we'll be seeing. A couple of things won't change right now, and that includes availability of vaccines and treatments. So to date, the government has purchased a very large supply of both vaccines and treatments like Paxlovid and made them available for free to the public. And that's going to continue. At least that's what the federal government's putting forth. And we don't know how long that's going to continue, but that is not going to change with the end of the declaration of the public health emergency next week.
So, yeah, I want to reiterate that because I think that's an important point, because I think people are thinking, okay, after May 11th, if I go for a vaccine, I've got to pay for it or hope my insurance is going to pay for it. You're saying that that's not the case.
Yeah, so the government has made it clear that at this point, those costs will be covered. I mean, I think eventually we may get to a point where that's no longer the case. And I think what happens at that point is still a little bit unknown, whether or not these vaccines will be handled like other vaccines, like the flu vaccine or other common vaccines, and be covered by insurance or paid for in that way. But, I think for now, at least, the government says they will continue to pay for these vaccines.
David, you touched on an interesting subject, and that's Paxlovid. Now that we've been using Paxlovid for a while, does it work? Is it worth taking?
So we're still seeing good data for Paxlovid. There's been more and more data that comes out showing that it does have benefit. Now, I think the overall benefit doesn't seem to be as high as it was originally. So you may recall in the early phases of the clinical studies, Paxlovid was primarily given to individuals who had no pre-existing immunity, so no vaccines, right. No prior infections, so kind of an immune-naive population. And the impact for Paxlovid was very impressive, remarkable, actually. So we have some more data that's come out that's shown that it is still impactful in terms of reducing severity, reducing hospitalizations, and really specifically on folks at higher risk. So I think we're still seeing that benefit from Paxlovid. But the magnitude may not be quite as much as what we saw originally, probably because of some of that that protective immunity from vaccination and infection that we see in the population now.
Do you still recommend taking it for individuals or less so?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a bit of an individualized decision. You know, I think, with these treatments, the most benefit is going to be in individuals with risk factors for severe infection. So I think that's the group that really benefits the most from Paxlovid. You know, in terms of tolerability and side effects, you know, we're seeing a very good side effect profile. People are tolerating it well, I think that's encouraging. So in terms of safety, I think there's a lot of reassurance that we're seeing now that we've prescribed it so much. I think the real focus is on those higher risk individuals by age or medical comorbidities.
Just quickly, where are we with masks? So when people go to a hospital or go see a doctor now in any situation, where are we with the requirement for masks?
So I think, at this point, the state no longer has any masking requirements at all in healthcare facilities as well. And different hospitals have taken different approaches to masking. At UConn Health, we recently relaxed a lot of our masking requirements, particularly in ambulatory clinics and non-clinical areas of the facility. You know, we're still requiring masking for healthcare workers in some situations, particularly when taking care of vulnerable patients in the hospital and some other settings. I think different hospitals have taken different approaches in terms of sort of scaling back requirements. I think in general in the public, their mask requirements are long gone. But in healthcare facilities, we may still continue to see masking, but it'll be more focused on vulnerable patient populations.
In our last minute, any prediction for the fall, David?
You know, I think a little difficult to predict with this virus. I think the optimistic prediction is that COVID will sort of conform to our usual respiratory viruses that we see. It'll be part of that picture with flu, and there may be some seasonality to it in the winter. We may see some uptick. I think COVID will stay with us. It's certainly not going to be gone, and it will still have some impact on the population. But, we always have to keep a close eye on it. We've seen COVID change. We've seen new variants emerge, and we still have to be mindful of that things could change in the future. But I think overall, there's some optimism moving into the summer and this coming fall.
David, thank you for your time, and thanks for everything you do. I got to get you back on because I did want to touch on the RSV vaccine that's just come out. So sometime before the fall, I'll get you back on, and we need to chat more about that. Thank you again for your time, buddy. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. That was Dr. David Banik from the University of Connecticut. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest for the second half of today's program, Dr. Alexander Mbebwe, and we're going to be talking about palliative care. If you have any questions, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to welcome my guest, Dr. Alexander Mbebwe. He is a specialist in palliative care at the William W. Backus Hospital, part of Hartford Healthcare, and he's agreed to join us to talk a little bit about his field of medicine. Alex, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tony. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start with what is palliative care? What do we need to know about this?
Yes, that's a very good question. So palliative care, it's specialized interdisciplinary medical care for people living with a serious illness, such as heart failure or cancer. And patients who receive palliative care may receive medical care for their symptoms, which is what basically palliative care is, along with treatment intended to cure their serious illness. And patients who are usually referred to palliative care are referred by a specialist such as a cardiologist or a pulmonary specialist such as for management of their pulmonary symptoms, or a cancer specialist like an oncologist for management of symptoms related to cancer. And we can help with management of that symptom, of those symptoms from the onset of their illness. So palliative care really encompasses helping to manage the symptoms right from the start and working along with the patient as they face this challenging illness. It's also really important to know that palliative care also involves helping the family members cope with a loved one's illness. And so, which is why the palliative care teams are composed of an interdisciplinary group of people. So on our team, we have a chaplain, we have a social worker, and we have a nurse practitioner too. This way, we can really make sure that all the issues are addressed, not just for the patient's symptoms, but also what the family members are coping with.
I appreciate that explanation, because it's explained things to me, and you know, when I have questions and I practice medicine, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have similar questions. Let me just back up a little bit. So in terms of treatment, right, most of the patients referred for palliative care, I would think, are eventually terminal. I mean, we all are, but are in some way. How does it interrelate with like people who go to hospice, for example? When we looked at Jimmy Carter, right, he was referred to hospice. So a lot of discussion came with palliative care. So how do the two things interrelate?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a very good question, and we encounter it quite commonly. So we can think of a serious illness on a continuum. So from the time that somebody, say, is diagnosed with, like for Jimmy Carter, with a cancer, you know, as the patient is seeing the oncologist, they could also start to see a palliative care specialist at the same time. And usually at the beginning of the illness, the palliative care specialist will be helping the oncologist to manage a lot of the symptoms, such as the pain, nausea, the sleeplessness, anxiety, or depression, while the oncologist focuses more on trying to treat this particular cancer. And as the illness progresses, normally if somebody's life expectancy is then 6 months or less, that is where hospice care begins to step into the picture. And hospice care provides very similar services to palliative care. The only major difference is that it's usually more towards the end of somebody's illness, when they're really approaching that last 6 months of their illness, based on the estimate of their specialist, such as an oncologist or cardiologist or pulmonary specialist. But palliative care basically is present throughout a patient's illness, and it's really meant to support the patient, the family members, and to help the specialist too, because many times the oncologists, say, may be very specialized, and it really helps if they can really focus their treatments on really trying to treat this particular type of cancer in an aggressive way, such that it stops to grow or it shrinks. And then we can really help provide that specialized support for management of pain and those type of symptoms.
Are most of the patients inpatients, or are they outpatients as well?
So at Bacchus Hospital, we have an inpatient team. We are in the process of setting up an outpatient clinic, but it's not yet up and running. So we get referrals from the hospitalist physicians, who are basically the hospital doctors looking after patients who have been hospitalized. And if they have intractable symptoms, you know, that are very hard to manage, they will normally consult one of us to come and check up on the patient. We also get referrals from specialists who are also seeing the patients. And in programs which are much more established, which have been there for much longer amount of time, so in this state, the Yale New Haven program has been present, I would say, for the last 15 years or so. They have an outpatient clinic too, which is already up and running. So they do both aspects of type of care. We so far only doing the inpatient, but hopefully within the next 6 months to 12 months, we'll establish an outpatient clinic too.
Let's talk about training. So you're an internist. Are most of the people who go into palliative care from internal medicine, or are there other specialties that go into that?
Yeah, so I did my initial training in internal medicine, and subsequently I did my palliative care training. Because the need for palliative care is so high, the American Board of Medical Specialties has made it in such a way that essentially it's almost up to about 10 different specialties can get that additional training in palliative care. So it's open to anesthesiologists, it's open to neurologists, to pediatricians, it's open to emergency medicine physicians. And, you know, that just, again, the main reason for that is that we just need so many specialists, you know. And so it's really training which is open to almost any field of training. Many times what I've noticed while in practice is that many of the people who train in palliative care usually do it towards, like, I would say the second half of their career after having practiced as a specialist for the initial decade or so. Usually then they take up the specialty of palliative care. And I think part of it is, I think when most people are practicing, they begin to notice that there is that lack of treating symptoms adequately. There is a lack of supporting family members through serious illnesses. And so the wish is to really provide better care for patients and their family members. And so I think that's the main reason that many physicians go into this field.
What's a typical day like for you?
Yeah, so a typical day normally in the morning, so I meet with the interdisciplinary team. That's the chaplain, the social worker, the nurse practitioner, and we have another physician who is based out of Wyndham Hospital. And we basically review the overnight events for the patients that we're following. And then we review any of the new requests, any of the new consult requests that the hospitalists or specialists have requested for both Bacchus and Wyndham Hospital. And based on the review of the information that's been provided to us, we kind of try to delineate which one of us would best serve the patient. So we might say, okay, I think these two patients need to be seen by the chaplain, this patient by the social worker, and this patient by the nurse practitioner, and then this patient by the physician. So it really depends on, you know, like what the requesting physician is also asking us, what their question is. And from there, we go about our day, we see the patients, and then we normally reconvene again at about 2, 3 p.m. to have a plan for the rest of the day and what exactly to sign out to the night physicians who will be coming into the hospital. And that's usually a typical day. We always try to leave room within the day for any emergencies that might occur, because invariably sometimes we're called to see very critically ill patients where we have to meet with family members and try to bridge the gaps in communication about somebody's prognosis, about the different treatments for options which are available and such things.
So do you find, I've often found one of the biggest obstacles, you touched on the word communication, and communicating and getting an understanding from the patient and especially their family in these situations. Would you agree that that's probably the biggest obstacle?
Oh, yes, definitely. That's definitely the biggest obstacle. And so, you know, when a hospital has a palliative care team, it really helps to bridge those gaps in communication. Because I think if the family members are hearing from a specialist, you know, sometimes the specialists might be kind of in their own hyper-specialized world, and they might be using a lot of terms which are not easy to understand from people who don't work in healthcare. And so we really try to bridge that gap. You know, we try to dedicate focused time to meet with the family members in person, preferably. And we go over as much medical information as possible. We try to really distill it in such a way that it can really be understood. And then we also try to go over the different treatment options. So normally, at the same time as we communicate with the family members, we communicate with the specialist. So usually before meeting with the family members, we also talk to the specialist. We get their take on exactly what's happening. And then we try to relay that information to the family members and to the patient. And the key being that we're really trying to align the care which the patient receives with what the patient's goals of care are, to make sure that the treatments are getting really appropriate with what they value, so that they do not get treatments which are inappropriate, and, you know, we just make sure that we're really following their wishes.
Here's where I think it gets tricky, Alex, at least from my experiences in dealing with patients, is when you're dealing with different cultural norms, right? And so how do you get around that? I mean, how do you, because there are obviously different cultures that look at this process. And I mean, it's, dying is a process. And how do you deal with that, with trying to work with the different cultural norms? Because we deal with so many cultures here in Connecticut. How do you do that?
Right. Yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges that we have. And, you know, one of the things that we find sometimes helps is dedicating a lot more time for those patients and family members who might have a different cultural background, and just really taking the time to explain everything as much as possible, and assigning more team members to meet with the family members. So not just one of the team members, but the social worker, the chaplain, the physician, and nurse practitioner, and meeting with them on multiple days, over many, many days, and several times, and really being available to them as much as possible in case they have questions or if another family member has a question. And I think just taking that time to hear them as much as possible, you know, that's what we find that really works the best.
You know, this is never taught in medical school. Well, maybe it's taught in medical school now. I hope it is, because when I went to medical school, obviously, we didn't learn much about dying. I didn't learn much about dying until I had to experience it in my own family. And can you talk a little bit about the process when someone is going through what is a terminal illness? And we have so many of them. There's cancer, there's ALS, there are these pulmonary conditions and things such as that. Can you talk a little bit about the process that the patient and family are going through?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a very, very challenging time for patients and their family members, you know, when a serious illness has progressed to such an extent that they have very limited life expectancy. And we really try to focus on making sure that the symptoms are really adequately controlled as somebody is nearing the end. So there is a big benefit to hospice care as somebody approaches the end of their life. And one of those benefits, again, is they provide a lot of support to family members. They have bereavement counselors who are also able to support family members up to a year after somebody's passing. And so that helps to prevent depression. It helps to prevent suicides in family members. So it's really very beneficial towards, you know, managing and supporting the family members as they deal with their loved ones approaching end-of-life care. So that's one aspect. You know, we really try to make sure that we manage pain in an adequate way. So if somebody is in a hospital and they're receiving hospice care, it gives that additional layer of support. So in addition to the regular nurses that are able to look after the patient in the hospital, there is also a hospice nurse who is checking up on the patient. And so there are more eyes available to monitor the symptoms and to treat them adequately before they get out of hand, you know. And it's really challenging. And I think many hospitals are beginning to have palliative care teams within their workforce, and because they do realize that, you know, we can do much better than what we're able to do these days. And it's, the one thing I would say for family members whose loved one is really facing a terminal illness is to ask for a referral for palliative care when they're in the hospital, or even when they're seeing their specialist in the outpatient setting. And usually that will really go a long way in helping the family members get the adequate support they need, and the patient too.
I have a question for you and that I experienced in my practice, and that is for physicians and healthcare providers. After someone passes, going to the wake or whatever there is, a funeral or something of that nature. I've done it in the past with my patients who, you know, I've developed a bond with. I felt like I was part of the family to a large extent. But is that recommended for physicians to do? Do you guys do that? Do people in your team, in other words, it seems like it's a tremendous support for the family to see somebody. It just wasn't this hospital experience. Do people on your team do that?
Yes, we do that. And we really try to keep in touch with the family members. We will normally send like a bereavement card when somebody has passed to give them some support, you know, because the process just doesn't end when somebody passes, you know. And we really establish very strong bonds with the patients and the family members, which is at the core of that clinician-patient relationship. And, you know, because those bonds are really strong, many times we do go to the funeral, we will send, you know, bereavement cards and things like that. And we call the family members just to check up on them to see how they're coping and how they're doing, how best we can help. And I think it's also at the core of just providing good medical care. It feels very rewarding to be able to do that. And I think it also helps to prevent burnout in the clinicians, you know. Many times, I'm more than sure you've heard this topic quite a lot about burnout in physicians and nurse practitioners. And one of the reasons for burnout, which many people think it's quite prevalent, is the fact that sometimes we feel the work that we do might be kind of meaningless, where we're filling out reams of paperwork or dealing with insurance companies. And when we pivot and we focus more on managing symptoms, on supporting family members, on being present for to the family members even after their loved one has passed away, it really gives us that sense that this is why we went into medicine. And that helps to prevent burnout in clinicians. And so we really go out of our way to make sure that we do that as much as possible.
Alex, we've spent a lot of time talking about the challenges of palliative care, but what's the most rewarding part of your job?
Yeah, the most rewarding part is actually managing to treat the symptoms adequately and supporting the family members, you know. They're just providing really good medical care to patients. And I think there is just no substitute for that, you know. So our big focus, again, because our specialty is very clinical, we don't focus as much on the findings on a CAT scan or an MRI or a particular lab result. We really, everything boils down to, is somebody adequately treated in terms of, is their pain under good control? Is their shortness of breath such that they are able to obtain some relief from that symptom, and maybe then they're able to communicate with their family members and not be short of breath to the point where they can't speak? And is their anxiety controlled? And is their ability to stay awake while, say, during the daytime and communicate with family members, they're able to do that while at the same time having their pain adequately controlled? So when we address all those symptoms and the patient is doing relatively well and we're able to support the family members, that's just the most gratifying feeling ever.
It's great, because what you're saying is basically your job is to focus on the art of medicine and not the technology. And I find that so refreshing to hear from you. I want to thank you for spending time really with us today and for everything you do. I've certainly learned a lot in this conversation, and I'm sure many of the listeners have. Alex, thank you again for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. I want to thank my guest today, but I want to touch on a few topics. First of all, I want to thank the listeners who emailed me over their condolences over the passing of my dad. Many thanks to all of you, and it is great to feel like we're all a part of something and a struggle to learn more about health and promote better health. To that effect, next week, we're going to talk about loneliness next week. A recent study showed that widespread loneliness in the U.S. poses a health risk as deadly as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So we're going to chat about that and see what we need to do about rectifying that. Again, thanks to our guests today, Dr. David Banik and Dr. Alex Mbebwe, who really spent some time educating all of us. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. As always, Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week on Healthy Rounds, we're going to be talking about a lot of topics, but as I mentioned, we're going to talk about loneliness. If you have any questions for me during the week, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast. And actually, I think the interviews today would be worth re-listening to, even if you were listening to the program. Next up on WTIC is Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.